Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Calvin.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three guys who love the classic Doctor Who series and are doing our best to love the new series, too. We'll take you through five rounds, wrap it, and get to the bottom of what's great and not so great about our favorite show. And in this minisode, we are talking about Before the Flood by Toby Whithouse, the second part of last week's episode, Under the Lake. I couldn't remember. I know the titles go together, but they still...
I almost called it Before the Lake.
Before the Lake. Under the Flood. They both work. We will start with round one, Temporal Grace. We like to kick off each minisode with something positive. So we will each share one thing we liked, really liked about this episode. Calvin?
I'm gonna pick kind of a weird, possibly lame choice and just say the dam breaking effect.
Oh, that is an interesting choice.
Normally, when you try and do something on a big destructive scale like that on a TV show, it kind of doesn't work so well. But I thought it worked well.
Well, I got a question for you guys about that. That's some type of visual reference that I'm not quite remembering, right? With the Fisher King with his arms outspread in front of that oncoming water, right?
It might be
our Ten Commandments.
Yes.
Moses parting the Red Sea. The thing it most reminded me of probably would be X-Men 2.
And the Ten Commandments.
Yeah. Basically the same film. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's still not scratching that itch in the back of my head that says I've seen this exact shot before, but maybe our listeners can write in and suggest more.
Internet research. That's what this needs.
Crowdsourcing.
Yep.
Pat, what did you like?
Well, I quite liked the design of the Fisher King itself. I thought it was really creepy. It was visually imposing, looming over Peter Capaldi there in the shadows. Honestly, they should have kept him in the shadows a bit, because once he's thinking around outside in the sunlight, it looks a little bit tragic. But, you know, that's par for the course of the Doctor Who.
Yes, and to go back to Kelvin's wild speculations last episode, the Fisher King's face and the way his mouth was kind of open in a disgusting kind of split manner was the same as that serpent mural that distressed Kelvin so much. So
that could be. That could be.
I think it was sort of a depiction, a mythic depiction of the events or the Fisher King attack, perhaps. Wild, unfounded analysis instead of speculation. So, well, I like a number of things, but my favorite dumb, tiny little blink and you'll miss it thing is the doctor's clockwork squirrel that is sitting on top of his amp in the cold open. Close-up of the doctor's hand going to the amp, and sitting on top of it is the clockwork squirrel that got mentioned in the previous episode. So there you go. There's a clockwork squirrel hidden in there. Made me happy.
Wow, I didn't even catch that. No, I'm not going to see anything but the clockwork squirrel the next time I watch this.
You got to be attuned to clockwork animals. All right, round two. So we're going to talk a little about the 12th Doctor's characterization in this particular episode. Sounds like Pat has some observations.
I thought they did a fairly good job with Peter Capaldi agonizing over whether he could ethically change history, change a future that has already happened, and or change... actually practically change the future that had happened. They finessed that in a couple of different ways. Clara seemed to consider it some type of actual choice when she's telling him, no, you can't die, you're, you know, you owe this to me, you can't abandon me right now. And he seemed to view it as a sort of law of nature that can't be changed. But these things, these ethical laws and laws of nature, get very blurry when you're talking about Time Lords who can, and apparently have, in the Time Lord War, have changed continuity itself. So this is an unending morass of possible fan fiction speculation when you get into what the rules of time travel actually are. But I think here, Capaldi did quite a good job of walking that balance between I'm upset because this is something that I don't want to do, and I'm upset that this is something that it is physically impossible for me to do. And they sort of split the difference there at the end of the episode by having him not do a timey-wimey explanation for how he got out of it. You know, it's kind of similar to the end of the last two-parter where I thought it was going to go into time travel shenanigans, and here it didn't really. He pretended that it did. He pretended to the Fisher King that that was what he was going to do, but then resolved it on a very normal Doctor Who-y level.
Yeah, and it seems like it's that characterization of the 12th Doctor feels right, that very trying to figure things out. It's the same, you know, calculating on a chalkboard quality, or when he's doodling in the sand at the end of Mummy on the Orient Express, that the wheels are constantly turning. And that's true of all the characterizations of the Doctor, but it seems particularly intensely true for him, and I like that characterization. And I intentionally did not read any other reviews online or anything, so I don't know if that cold open was a contentious thing among reviewers or fans, but I have to say Peter Capaldi really pulled it off, and I really, really enjoyed it. The fourth wall down, talking straight. Now, he's kind of talking straight to the camera, but at the same time, with his characterization, with things like listen, that also sort of opens in a similar way. The fact that he thinks out loud possibly more than a lot of other doctors who talk a lot, but it's different from thinking out loud. He's not filibustering as much as other incarnations. And so
the breaking the fourth wall thing really seems to be a signature thing of the 12th Doctor. I'm glad they're not doing it, like, right in the middle of the show where, like, I don't know, what's the only example I can think of where that happens off the top of my head is like in Ferris Bueller's Day Off or something, where he just stops like whatever he's doing and just starts narrating things. I'm glad they're not doing that. But
Tom Baker used to look at the camera and give some sort of cheesy glance toward the viewer too. So yeah, we don't need that anymore. You know, if you told me a year ago that, the Doctor plays electric guitar now, I would have, you know, I don't know, shot myself, but maybe it's Stockholm Syndrome, but I'm okay with it. It feels okay to me now.
Again, I think it's a combination of Peter Capaldi just being an older person, so it doesn't look like, hey, look how hip we are or something. And it could just simply be that Peter Capaldi can actually play the guitar.
All right, well, we like the 12th Doctor in this one, it seems.
So I'm glad that computer had a sunglasses input, because otherwise that would have been very challenging, right? Like, I don't know how they build inputs 150 years in the future, but apparently it's for sunglasses. Okay.
I think the whole sunglasses thing is just this sort of Moffat's, you know, love of just being ironic, and a lot of people complained about the sonic screwdriver, and he seems to somewhat successfully just making the point, it doesn't matter what it is, it is a stupid, contrived thing, and so, you know, he's just going to stick his sunglasses in here where he would have, if he had a sonic screwdriver, he would have aimed it at it, and...
Yeah, you know, you're totally right. It's, for some reason, because it was a computer input, it stuck out for me. But, yeah, I mean, when he wastes the sonic screwdriver, I don't really think about it very much because I think of it like Harry Potter's magic wand or whatever. Like, oh, okay, it just makes the plot happen. But here, because they had a a technological interface, it suddenly came a little bit too close to realism for me, and that's when I, my record skipped. But yeah, you're right. I obviously I'm not going to make a big deal out of it, but for some reason that triggered me in a way that the screwdriver never did. Ah, interesting. I learned things about myself on this podcast.
Really, dude, it's cheaper than therapy. All right, round three. Yes, friends and foes. Let's talk a little about Clara in this one. Is there really anything to talk about?
It's just continuing Clara as, deputy doctor, I guess. You know, a pseudo doctor-companion relationship with Clara and Cass.
That's true.
Going like, well, what's wrong with you? And, you know, they get split up in a kind of a dumb mistake sort of way. Yeah, which actually leads to one of my favorite scenes in an episode, which is the ghost dragging the axe and it's following Cass, and Cass can't hear the axe being dragged.
Oh, yeah, that was a great scene.
I should have picked that instead of the damn busting thing, but oh well.
No, the future's been written, Kelvin. And yeah, listeners are listening to this, the future has already happened, and there's nothing that we can do.
We can't go back. We can't change one line of this podcast.
It's all darn linear time track podcasting.
Oh, so I want to say about friends and foes, for the most part, I thought, well, actually, I'll just go ahead and say universally, I thought that all of the guest actors in these two parts were terrific, because on the page, I don't think there's really much to their characters at all. They're very thinly established. There's not much by way of character there, but for some reason, all the actors brought a lot of soul to their roles, and so I really dug all of them, with the possible exception of the fangirl, I think, O'Donnell. The actress was fine, but I think it suffered a little bit under the weight of, oh, look, here's another in-universe person who's a fanboy or fangirl about the Doctor, like Lee Evans from Planet of the Dead, right? Osgood, yeah, right. It's just over and over again, it pops up, and I'm frankly tired of it.
So repetitive that it made me wonder if it is somehow connected to Osgood, because she's coming back in a handful of episodes, or the actress is, you know, whether or not she's really dead or whether it's a Zygon double or what. It seemed it's another ex-unit female who's a huge fan of the Doctor's.
They gave her a lot of backstory for no particular reason, right? She dangled a guy out of the window, and so she was drummed out of military intelligence. It was... There are odd details that stick out without having any bearing on the plot whatsoever, as far as I can tell.
I think it's just a way of making the character more memorable so her death is more meaningful.
Yeah, that's probably the case.
Why the Fisher King?
Yeah, I know a bit about the mythology, and maybe I'm just failing my library use roles or whatever, but I can't quite figure out what the significance of the name is, except that he was wounded and restored, but that's not even really the case. This is more of a death and resurrection show for him. It's not like the weird sexual symbolism of the Fisher King getting wounded in the thigh or the groin and having to be restored, and there's no Holy Grail that the Fisher King is protecting or whatever. The whole thing is scrambled. The entire episode sort of got scrambled for me because I was trying to figure out the name. Like, what? Is there some sort of allegorical significance to this that I'm not getting? But I don't think there is. I think it just sounded good to Toby Whithouse.
It was a little odd and a little disappointing because it's such a strong name and such a strong piece of myth that it's a shame that it was a distraction.
There's some medievalist elements to it with that mural that we talked about last week with the sea serpents and stuff,
yeah.
Medieval ships and stuff, but I couldn't make really any sense of that, and in the same way that I couldn't make a lot of sense of the thematics of the Soviet kitsch that was going on. And it's got a plot reason, I guess, because they chose to set it in this striking location, but there weren't any Cold War thematics or Soviet thematics that I could think of either.
I'll admit I was too lazy to Google this, but was there an actual military base in Scotland that had, like, an actual dam flood situation? I mean, you know, is this based on, like, an actual historical thing?
I don't know. Listeners,
What about the Undertaker?
Oh, he was fun.
Yeah, I like that guy.
I was really worried about him at first because I thought he was going to be like the comic relief for the entire episode. I think they used him wisely. They let him be humorous and pathetic, and they got rid of him quickly.
He gets off pretty quick, you know?
Yeah, he would have overstayed his welcome, but I thought it was just the right amount.
I think Toby Whithouse realizes the Tivoli should be used sparingly.
Let's go to round four, the big picture, and talk about the whole darn episode.
The bootstrap paradox. This is something that I now have a name for. It's been a science fiction cliche for a really long time, right? But
yes.
I'd never actually gotten heard the term before. I remember as a kid, you'll excuse me as I digress into autobiography, as I like to do, there were a couple of this thing showed up in a lot of the science fiction that I read, and it annoyed me all the time because you just couldn't figure it out, right? I'm thinking specifically of Harry Harrison's third Stainless Steel Rat book, which has this crazy bootstrap paradox thing where somebody is constantly going through their own timeline and redoing the same events, and Michael Moorcock's novel Behold the Man, where a guy goes back in time and becomes Jesus. So, but in both of those and in other things that I can't think of, you just can't figure out where the information is coming from. Like, you can determine physically where somebody has gone back in time and what they're doing, but you can't determine where the information is coming from. And that's exactly what Capaldi is saying at the beginning there, right, with his Beethoven analogy. Go back in time, there's no Beethoven, you can supply Beethoven's music, but then you heard that music from somewhere, and you're delivering that music to the appropriate time period, so where did the music come from in the first place? It doesn't have a beginning or an end, that information. And I think this is one of those fundamental, like, crazy things about time travel, that if it actually existed, this would be an insoluble paradox. Information could be created without anybody actually creating it, and that's nonsense, of course. But I really liked what they did in this episode, where they avoided the time travel trap of having the Doctor change the future. So they finessed over the problem about whether that was actually possible, physically possible or ethically possible, and instead kind of diverted everything into this weird little bootstrap paradox channel where there's still a sort of time travel conundrum that even the Doctor apparently doesn't know how to solve, and it's something for the viewers to kind of think on and dwell on without getting tied up in how this might unravel the entire narrative structure of Doctor Who and make nothing mean anything. if that makes any sense.
Yeah, because with the opening sequence, it gives it an artificial sense of a tidy conclusion, when in reality, part of the conclusion is the Doctor and the audience doesn't know how the hell it could have happened that way. But it seems very elegant, even though it's really inexplicable. I thought this one improved greatly on the first one. They have, I feel, two-part stories in a row where the second part is stronger than the first, which is good job for the new series, because usually it's not.
Well, yeah. Josh, I hate agreeing with you, but I do. I liked this one quite a bit. Maybe it was subjective, maybe it was when I watched it and my mood or whatever, but I relaxed and enjoyed this, even though it was attempting more than the base under siege thing of the first part. Yeah, so I dug it.
They never really answered any of our metaphysical concerns. In fact, they were possibly more concerning in this story, but it was sort of a brush away at the end where it was just we have these souls trapped and we'll throw them out in space and they'll dissipate. That's really weird, like gas, spiritual fire.
Oh, terrible. What does it mean? Are they destroying the consciousness of these human beings that they loved? There's some implication there with the guy with the glasses looking in and like, oh, that's the person who I loved, but I don't know, and you should tell everybody you love that you love them before their souls get ripped out of their body and they turn into murderers. But What? Are they actually those people? Are they those people trapped there? Is that what they are? Or is it just some weird, you know, hologrammatic reflection of what they were? It's completely unresolved, of course.
It seemed pretty clear to me that they're just empty echoes of the person.
They said souls, and once you say that, that suggests the truth of the person continuing to exist. And they couldn't decide. They kind of want to sweep it under the rug at the end, but they also, I think, wanted it to be souls or something like that for the doctor to be very indignant about it, as you would be in the previous story. So I think it was a semantic thing, and maybe someone else listening or watching it might just go, oh, yeah, they mean consciousness, they mean echo, like you said. But I think in the story, with the words they chose, it has a little bit of an alarming thought to it.
Yeah, I knew who has a lot of this, right? They have one construction on events to allow the doctor to get indignant and pissed off about things, and then another construction on events to make the viewer feel a little bit okay about what's going on. Like, if these were really souls being ripped out of their body and enslaved by the Fisher King, oh, that's a terrible horror story, right? I mean, that's a tragedy. Something really that the doctor should be upset about. But, you know, if it's just kind of, you know, electronic echoes of what they were, then, okay, that's gross, but we can dissipate them in space and we don't need to feel very much about it. Yeah, which is it? Who knows?
So do we want to score this? Let's start with Pat, who's the stingiest of us thus far in the ratings.
Well, I'm feeling generous this week. So out of 5, I'm going to give it 4 hours of Wagner's opera Parsifal. Now, the opera is actually 5 hours long, but everyone in the world wishes it were 4 hours, so this is even more generous.
Who could listen to 5 hours of grand opera? I don't know. I am going to give it 3.5 billboard-sized portraits of Lenin. Yeah, you know, the Fisher King wasn't really that great of a villain to me. He's just kind of there. He doesn't really do anything, and, you know, why the hell is he called the Fisher King? I don't know. But I still enjoyed it.
I give it 4 clockwork squirrels. I really liked it. Might even not do 4.5 clockwork squirrels, except a half a clockwork squirrel is really sad and pathetic. So, 4 episodes in a row that I found fun to watch. I don't know what to do with myself.
You know, there was a tweet from local writer Rob Callahan, who actually tweeted something along the lines of, this is the best season of the new Doctor Who series yet. And, of course, there were a lot of people tweeting back to him like, you are out of your gourd. Come on. Moffat needs to be brushed aside like yesterday's lint.
Yeah, speaking of a man who has brushed away yesterday's lint, it sounds like we should probably have Rob Callahan on the show to defend that position at some point. But we'll put a pin in that later.
It could be just a spontaneous burst of enthusiasm after a couple IPAs or something. But, you know.
All right, well, round 5, wild speculation. There's not a lot from this episode that I think hints toward the future of the season.
O'Connell says some stuff.
She mentioned the Minister of War, which the Doctor doesn't remember doing yet. Might be just a little throwaway thing for nerds like us to chew on endlessly, or it might be something.
Well, she also mentioned the darn moon dragon thing.
Yeah, you know, the moment this was broadcast, Kelvin, like a great scream came around Minneapolis. And I was like, oh, something must have referred to Kill the Moon. And that's Kelvin over.
I'm just like, oh, God, no, that's actually a thing and people remember it. Oh, God, okay.
Oh, by the way, last week's speculation, Josh, that the Doctor was in the cryo chamber.
Oh, yeah.
My speculation that the Doctor was going to use one of the energy cells to blow up whatever he needed to blow up. Both of these correct. Thank you.
Yeah.
So,
Kelvin,
I'm going to go on
totally wrong.
Totally wrong about Kill the Moon, although you're keeping it alive. God bless.
No, I think Kill the Moon is going to happen If it comes back, it's going to be like a season finale thing.
You think it could be a story arc?
I think it could be a season finale thing just because it's so huge and, you know, like, oh, this is the biggest Doctor Who monster ever. It'll be awesome because that was the thinking that brought us Power of Kroll, and we all know how that turned out. But
you think there might be a whole big finish arc centered around the Moon Dragon?
There could be something. There could be like an audio adventure of the Seventh Doctor encountering the Moon Dragon or something.
Over with Jago and Lightfoot. Okay, so the only thing that I will speculate about is that in this next two-parter, Maisie Williams will be some inelegant version of Arya Stark from Game of Thrones without the nuance. She'll be like some tough little girl warrior. That's what I'm speculating on.
Yeah, well, I got nothing. I'm honestly just really, not to sound too much like Rob Callahan, I'm just really enjoying this season. I'm sure it'll crash and burn next week.
Yeah, we're due for a fall.
On that note,
the stock market goes up, the stock market goes down. You can't bet on which way it's going to go. What have I compared Doctor Who to in this podcast? I've compared it to the stock market. I've compared it to the Ten Commandments. I've compared it to X-Men 2.
Well, I'm going to say goodbye before this actually continues. Until next time, I'm Joshua.
I'm Pat.
And I'm Kelvin.
And we're saying, get off my world.
Oh, okay. Let me get my thoughts in order. You can edit all this out.
Okay. I'll add some rummaging sound effects as you get them in order.